All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, October 13th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here at UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is an overcast and damp 58 degrees and pretty miserable here today in upstate New York. One of those mornings that you probably could have stayed in bed. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Obama, Mars, CERN, and owning space. And over the last, it's going on almost 2 weeks now in space, and I promise this will be the end of this week. We'll move on to some other things, but it's been a pretty interesting rabbit hole we've dove down, and I haven't quite, and I always obviously have paid attention to space, but I haven't dug into any of this new stuff really until now with what is going on with battling as to who is going to own resources and planetary bodies now that we apparently are aiming to become a multi-planetary species. We've heard that a few times now. We looked at Elon Musk, of course, wanting to take a million people to Mars to be able to save humanity, quote-unquote. We've seen Zuckerberg and Hawking and the Russian billionaire going to fund searching Alpha Centauri to see what type of habitable life or habitable planets we potentially have over there. We have a mining company that is owned by a billionaire that has just gotten permission to go mine the moon. We also found out next Wednesday, and we're going to be on the air when this happens, so I don't know. I'll see if I can get something synced up. Maybe we can catch it live. But we have a landing by the European Space Agency as well as the Russian Roscosmos program that'll be landing on Mars, beating some of our newest plans to the punch, and adding a crowded gaggle of countries that are all competing, it appears, to get their hands on some of the riches that exist in outer space. We also found out that India has just had maybe their second anniversary with having a probe on Mars as well, and it's pretty damn bizarre. So then Obama comes out yesterday. It was yesterday. Well, according to the story, it was actually the day before. The story came out yesterday at 1 a.m. Obama vows to send people to Mars by 2030. We also found out, too, that Congress had approved $19.5 billion for this very purpose. So as we have a world here that is falling apart, as we have wars breaking out, we are potentially sitting here at the brink of World War III. I don't know. I just saw Lavrov and Putin. There were some video clips that came through Pigmine's feed from early hours of this morning of Lavrov and Putin at different points. They don't seem to be speaking any type of wartime rhetoric. They're kind of waiting to see what happens in this country, apparently. But I think Lavrov called everyone on all sides of the election pussies, which was kind of hysterically funny. But, you know, I mean, not even World War III, like we've looked at last week or this week even long before that, all of these new quote-unquote 21st century future weapons of mass destruction where we are splicing and dicing building blocks of life. We are quote-unquote, according to DARPA, going to terraform Mars. Now we find out why. They want to make it habitable so we can make our next mission there to become a multi-planetary species and superpowers in owning space. Now, don't forget, and that interview we heard by Bruce Gagnon that Libby Haleve aired last Saturday with us, talked about also the weaponization of space, the X-37B, which is very interesting because I've seen a few stories on that now over this last week, just out of the blue. Haven't heard anything in the longest time, and it just pops back out into public consciousness. But let's read this for a second. So Obama said the United States will partner with private industry to send people to Mars by 2030, adding commercial interests to Washington's previously announced plans. So that's kind of the big thing here. We have quote-unquote private industry, which are run by all these tech billionaires, internet billionaires, that are the same, very same billionaires that have been looking at longevity medicine and other 21st century investments that will all result in these disruptive technologies to turn us upside down on our head. We found out one of the issues potentially with going to Mars, which no one's really talking about, is the fact that the interstellar radiation could potentially cause long-term brain damage and chronic dementia. But don't worry about that, because one of the big projects we have going on globally is this brain project. Obama had talked about that at one point. There is a federal edict on this. And it discussed how 21st century medicine, genomics, brain studies are going to fuel this 21st century economy. So, you know, go to Mars. We might be able to fix it at some point with your preordained Mars Obamacare. So one of the big questions, though, we've asked, that's kind of where I'm going to direct today's studies, is the legalities of space, what the rules are, who really does own the moon and Mars? Why are we allowing these third-party companies to go up there? And sure, they might be paying for the initial mission, but we're finding out that companies such as SpaceX and, as a matter of fact, the mining company also, and I think I have a story we're going to look at them, promised yesterday, they are partnering with NASA. And if they are partnering with NASA, that means that there are taxpayer dollars that are being utilized in these missions. So if they are going to profit from minerals and precious metals and precious rare earth minerals that they might mine off of these heavenly bodies, shouldn't we share in some of those riches? And what right do we have not only to contaminate these other bodies, but what right do we have as being planetary citizens with all these other countries to claim part of a heavenly body? I mean, shouldn't it be divvied up all nice and even then or something? So anyway, there was a story that came out the other day as Obama is announcing that we're going to have a mission with people on Mars by 2030. And money to fund all this. Story comes out of Gizmodo. Is Elon Musk's crazy Mars plan even legal? And this is his plan to save humanity by taking 1 million people off world. And I'd seen something about there were going to be a whole squadron of spaceships that could hold 100 people each, and they were going to ferry them back and forth. I think I got rid of that when I was running out of memory. 30, 40 tabs open in my browser. It kind of sucks your memory dry on your machine. Anyway, earlier this week, and this story was from September 26th, so this was already 2 weeks ago, Elon Musk revealed his plan to make humanity a multiplanetary species by building an express train to Mars. And actually, I think that link is the one that talks about it. SpaceX plans to build a self-sustaining city on Mars, according to its founder. But while we now know a lot more about how SpaceX plans to go to Mars, details about how people will actually survive up there remain sketchy. Now, we've dug into a bunch of that technology. It's a lot of where this DARPA shape-shifting matter projects are coming from. This is where even the little robot nanodoctors and the shape-shifting immune system comes in. This is where this molecular manufacturing that first DARPA podcast had talked about as well all fits in here. We're not going to have factories on planetary bodies. We're going to have to manufacture from the actual raw materials that we have. We're going to have to be able to protect ourselves without medications. There was a news story, too, about that Synlogix we've talked about. Those are these little programmable bacterias that they can make that will actually produce medications. Patrol your body, search for inflammation, and produce medications inside of you to cure what ails you. It's pretty freaky. I don't know. We might get there tomorrow. I'm going to look at some longevity medicine tomorrow, I think. But it's pretty insane. So, you know, they're not actually saying that all this stuff is from Mars, but I'm telling you, that's where it's headed. And we've already found stories about them talking about using synthetic biology, and this is DARPA specifically, to terraform Mars in order to make it habitable. So it's not that much of a stretch of the imagination. So anyway, back to the sea lion story, whether or not it is legal, there are a lot of open questions about how Musk's express train to Mars will work, technically speaking, and who will pay for it. Well, again, SpaceX is in partnership with NASA. They said they were leasing a big part of that Kennedy space station, and I also thought, the Kennedy Space Launch Area in Florida, but they also... we're utilizing some of that New Mexico spaceport as well. I saw a story not too long ago that they were also building their own launch facilities in the eastern Texas. So Musk is dedicating a lot of resources to this. So anyway, there's another fundamental issue that must be addressed before anybody can reserve a seat on this first spaceship out. And remember, we found out $200,000 a piece for a ticket to Mars, and like Musk said, it's about the average price of a U.S. house, so screw it. If you don't want to stay here, you better be prepared to die. Get on your dopamine big boy pants, and let's go cowboy it to Mars. It's the wild frontier. But is going to Mars even legal? Well, they posed that question to Joanne Grabiskowitz, who's the director of the International Institute of Space Law. Now, did you know we have one of those? The short answer is that there is no legal framework governing most of what Musk has outlined in his vision. And right now, this billionaire doesn't even have permission to send a single robotic probe to Mars, much less thousands, if not a million, Earth citizens. Remember, we talked about this approval process that just happens to be able to mine Mars. There was a company, the Moon Express. They were one of the winners of the Google SpaceX competition I was reading. And they had just received approval, but it was this entire governing body that I had tried to remember yesterday, and I verified that the FAA gave the final approval. I thought that was kind of odd, even though they're Federal Aviation Administration. You know, how far up does that go? Apparently it goes beyond just 30,000 feet. But it says here, and it even mentions this, in the United States, the FAA has jurisdiction to license what goes up in orbit, but we found out that it includes the DOD and a bunch of other entities. But what comes back down to Earth is also included. And as soon as you're in orbit, or heading to another celestial body, the rules start to get fuzzy. At the moment, there is no legal regime for on-orbit activities, says Grabiskowitz. Right now, any U.S. company wishing to do something in space has to be authorized by the appropriate federal agency, usually the FAA or the Department of State. And yes, they were another one that was involved, as well as the DOD. And they determine whether or not there's any threat to national security. For instance, last month, Google Lunar X Prize contender Moon Express, ding, ding, this is the one owned by the billionaire, received a quote-unquote favorable payload determination. So I guess that is the stamp of approval from the FAA for its request to stick a robotic lander on the moon. Basically, the feds decided the payload is not going to harm people or jeopardize U.S. national security, and so Moon Express can go right ahead. This was the very first time a private U.S. corporation received explicit permission to land on a celestial body. Now, what's pretty interesting is that all the stories that I read about that said that they had gotten permission to mine the moon, and this story says otherwise. Let's read a little bit further, and then we're going to hit a story about Moon Express. This approval was met with hearty victory whoops from the commercial space community, and there is a growing one, believe it or not, which took it as a sign that the feds may look favorably upon other deep space endeavors. But the FAA has made it clear that it was not setting any precedents. Quote, other companies or even Moon Express would have to undergo a similar payload review if they wanted to do something similar. Everything is on a case-by-case basis. What's more, getting a payload authorization is not the same as being licensed to conduct activity once you have landed. If you want to rove around on the surface, drill for precious metals, send a message back to Earth, or build a self-sustaining city, get this, you are going to need other licenses. You need licenses to even move around once you get there, or even send an email. And how insane is that? But hey, there's no legal precedent. We're just going to license the shit out of everything. There are no legal answers for humans. All we really know at this point is that under the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, and did you know we had one of those? The United States is responsible for any and all activities of a U.S. company engaging in another celestial body, engaging in on, it says, another celestial body. And in the case of SpaceX building a settlement on Mars, the U.S. is going to want to supervise and regulate that carefully. Yeah, you're going to be bagged and tagged. You're going to have to be vaccinated so you don't contaminate the environment. It's going to be a pretty frightening thing. And before I get too deep into SpaceX and their Mars colony, I really wanted to look at a story about that Moon Express mining the moon. Billionaire teams up with NASA. So see what I'm saying? They're talking about regulation and that, but they're teaming up with NASA, so they got it smart. SpaceX is teaming up with NASA as well, and maybe that's the way they got around that loophole. This story is from March of 2015, so this is even before that Gizmodo story. Moon Express, a Mountain View, California-based company that is aiming to send the first commercial robotic spacecraft to the moon next year, just took another step closer toward that lofty goal. Earlier this year, it became the first company to successfully test a prototype of a lunar lander at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Ding, the one that they're leasing. The success of this test and a series of others that will take place later this year paves its way for Moon Express to send its lander to the moon in 2016. Now, hold on, because this is older. Mining the moon. Express. What's that? Because that newest approval, I am pretty certain, gave them the right to mine. And maybe it wasn't within the last month. Yeah, well, here, The Verge. Lunar mission. Oh, well, hey, I don't know. Maybe they don't have permission to mine. Let's take a look here. Spaceflight Venture Moon Express wants to be the first private company to ever land on the moon in 2017, and now it has been granted approval by the United States government to launch the lunar surface. This is the first time the government has granted regulatory approval for a private mission beyond Earth, and Moon Express became very close to being denied permission to go. No regulatory framework currently exists for a commercial space mission to another world, and lawmakers are now working on a permanent solution, but it won't likely be ready in time for Moon Express's 2017 mission, so the company came up with its own temporary framework. Gotta love that. A regulatory patch that the U.S. government could use to oversee the company's mission. And after a meeting between the Federal Aviation Administration, the White House, the State Department, Moon Express has been given the approval it needs to launch to the moon. So far, commercial companies have mostly just launched satellites into space, which, yeah, I guess that would be kind of a precedent. All specialized private missions, like launching cargo to the space station, and they have all been overseen by NASA. And that means Moon Express could be the first private company to land on the moon, as well as the company that travels the farthest away from our planet. This regulatory patch is only temporary. Legislators are working on a long-term framework that will help the U.S. government oversee private deep space missions. And it all needs to happen soon, as space companies are getting more ambitious than ever. SpaceX announced its plan to send a spacecraft to Mars in 2018. And this is a new one. Bigelow Airspace wants to launch space hotels by 2020. And I think those are those little blow-up ones. Moon Express Lander is just one of the many deep space private missions to come. Remember, we read about the Playboy Mansion. Well, the Playboy Space Station. Also, I bet they'll have gambling up there, too. Moon Express needs to get to the moon by 2017, and that is the deadline for the Google Lunar XPRIZE, an international competition to send the first privately funded vehicle to the moon's surface. Moon Express joined the contest in 2012 and has since pushed ahead of the other 16 contenders. It is one of just two teams that have secured a launch contract, and the company has purchased a ride for its lander on the Electron rocket, which is a vehicle currently being built by startup Rocket Lab. And guys, how crazy is this? Like, this is where all this money is going, is to get us off this rock. I mean, is this really the future, is getting off of Earth? Because it's pretty disturbing that instead of trying to fix things that are so broken here right now, we are putting billions, $19.5 billion of taxpayer dollars into helping to send private corporations to other heavenly bodies to profit. It's insane. You know, I wanted to go back now to this other story. So whether or not it was legal, and this legal authority from the International Space, what organization? International Institute of Space Law, that they were interviewing, she had mentioned the Office for Outer Space Affairs and the treaty back in 1967 that we were a part of. I actually pulled that up. It is part of the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs. I did not know that we had one of these. This is titled Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including Moon and other celestial bodies. So apparently there's something on paper. The Outer Space Treaty was considered by the Legal Subcommittee in 1966. And an agreement was reached in the UN General Assembly in the same year, Resolution 2222. The treaty was largely based on the Declaration of Legal Principles governing the activity of states in the exploration and use of outer space, which had been adopted by the General Assembly in its resolution 1962 in 1963, but added a few new provisions. The treaty was open for signature by the three depository governments, the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom, and the United States of America, in January of 1967 and entered into force in October of 1967. The Outer Space Treaty provides the basic framework on international space law, including the following principles. So the three signors on this are Russia, UK, and the US. So these principles are included. One, the exploration and use of outer space shall be carried out for the benefit and in the interests of all countries and shall be the province of all of mankind. Well, ding. Isn't that what I was just saying? So wait a second. Why are we allowing then private companies to go profit from heavenly bodies in the moon? There's a UN Inc. treaty right here that says it should be for the interests and in the province of all mankind. Outer space shall be free for exploration and use for all states. Outer space is not subject to the national appropriation by claims of sovereignty, by means of use or occupation or by any other means, so you can't plant a flag in it, they're saying. The state shall not place nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction in orbit, ding, or on celestial bodies or station them in outer space in any other matter. So there are international laws about putting nukes in space, and it's questionable as to whether or not that's already been done. One of the things that's interesting is that Musk was suggesting last year about nuking the polar regions of Mars to melt the ice into liquid water. So I guess that's not going to work. And plus, I think it's a bad idea because you radiate the water. It wouldn't be very good. Number 4 or 5, the moon and other celestial bodies shall be used exclusively for peaceful purposes. So kind of like Antarctica, wink. Number 6, astronauts shall be regarded as envoys of mankind. So you better have a good moral character for going up there then. Number 7, states shall be responsible for national space activities, whether carried out by government or non-governmental entities. So regardless if you're commercial or not, you will still be governed by the United States, Russia, and or the UK. You know, I wonder, I think it did say that it was whatever country launched it is responsible for it. Number 8, states shall be liable for damage caused by their space objects. So if you got garbage floating around up there and it punctures a hole, whoops, you better pay to fix it. And if you contaminate a planet's surface, well, you're going to have a Superfund project for Mars then. And lastly, it looks like number 10, states shall avoid harmful contamination of space and celestial bodies. I would have to say that if I had to make up some space rules just off the fly, these would be some pretty good ones. So put a little feather in the cap for the United Nations there for once. I usually don't agree with them, but at least there's a little bit of a framework in place. But it still does not explain to me why right now we are talking about launching U.S. corporations that there are no rules saying they're going to kick back money to the human race for the good of all humanity. Or why even we are allowing a commercial entity. It just doesn't, I don't know. And the guy that's funding this this lander on the moon is a billionaire. He's going to get money from Google as well. So let's put Google on the moon. All right. All we really know at this point is that the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 gives the United States responsibility for any and all activity that a U.S. company engages in on another celestial body. And we did just read that statement. And in the case of SpaceX building a settlement on Mars, the U.S. is going to want to supervise and regulate carefully. And it stated that as well. Particularly given that several other tenants of the Outer Space Treaty, and we read there was the UK and Russia, the prohibition of nuclear weapons in space, and the mandate that states should avoid, quote-unquote, harmful contamination of celestial bodies, seem directly at odds with Musk's plan, and that would probably be the plan of nuking the poles. And let's not forget that the Outer Space Treaty also prohibits anyone from appropriating territory in space, which is planting our flag. That means under the current law, SpaceX's Martian colonists would be squatters or pirates. Yeah, you'd have to rent the land. It's going to be like the Gaza Strip up there. And that, however, may be the least of their worries from a legal protection standpoint. There are currently no legal answers for humans, says Grabinowitz. I'd need to know what their status is. Are they traveling as employees, tourists, or crew? I'd probably have to say they'd have to send them up as representatives, so maybe they'd have to kick them back funds for living up there. Some qubits on their card. What kind of contract is being negotiated? It would also be interesting with these people and the companies that they'd be going up for. Is there any exchanging of funds? Is it going to be a huge question to settle, or whether or not there are contractual agreements between the company and the person will be required? So how interesting is that? You'll have to ink your agreement with, I mean, how many of those sci-fi movies have you seen with the off-world mining companies and they're always, always a part of the system, and they pretty much are like owned and controlled because they're living in a place they can't get off of, and all of their sustenance depends upon the corporation. Bills like the American Space Renaissance Act, which I pulled up as well, did not know we had one of these either, which was introduced to Congress last spring, could start to fill many of the regulatory gaps surrounding robotic commercial activity in space, but must plan to start sending thousands, if not a million, colonists to Mars in the coming decades, raises major legal, if not to mention ethical, questions that are going to take a long time to sort out. Till then, space remains the Wild West, which may be precisely what a brilliant, ambitious, and slightly unhinged billionaire finds so appealing about it. Yeah, that's what I like about Elon Musk. He's brilliant, ambitious, and he's slightly unhinged. My type of person. All right, but like I said, I don't know. I still don't know how to take him. So a story comes out yesterday then. Obama now explains how NASA is going to get humans to Mars by 2030. Just in case all the recent headlines about SpaceX and Blue Origin, and that is Musk and Jeff Bezos' company, had you thinking about the future of space exploration and that they would be dominated by entirely private companies, Obama wants you to know that NASA is still squarely in the game. In his personal column published on CNN this Tuesday, and we read his personal statement. I mean, like, talk about Pravda propaganda arm. CNN is just pumping it out lately, and they're even letting Obama publish his personal column on CNN. Obama is recommitted to getting human astronauts on Mars in the next two decades and gave a new detail on how NASA plans to make this happen. He says, "We have set a clear goal vital to the next chapter of America's story in space. Sending humans to Mars by 2030 and returning them safely to Earth," which they keep saying they're going to do, but I don't see how that's possible, "with the ultimate ambition to one day remain there for an extended time. Getting to Mars will require continued cooperation between government and private investors, and we are already on our way." Now, one of the other things that we are not adding in here, we had read something, oh, probably maybe a month, maybe two, I don't know what days all bleed together, ago, about these new robots. There was this new robot competition that was like the next generation of this DARPA Robotics Challenge, where they were actually designing robots that could build, do you guys remember this, build structures as well as hook up power connectivity, like creating solar farms and that, that would be destined for two purposes specifically. One would be to send, first and foremost, before humans, to places such as Mars to get some sort of living facility set up before we send the first colonies. But the second use that they had discussed in the story for these very same robots would be to deploy them on U.S. soil in the event of some sort of FEMA or Homeland Security catastrophe. Now, just imagine this. So they're building these intelligent, artificially intelligent robots that can go build things, and they probably will have some sort of Baxter-esque type cloud learning, downloading, uploading capability. Because, you know, they're going to have something like that. They can upload new programs, and have it go, zoop, 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 all right, we're going to create this now. They could be practicing at some of their facilities down at that Kennedy Space Center and recording it on their on-world robot, uploading that learning process to the cloud and then beaming it to Mars. I mean, they have that capability. Might be a little bit slow, but it'll get there. Just think about that. We have these AI bots that, you know, of course, they're being created for one purpose and always have that dual-edged sword. Imagine, just imagine, a squadron. We have large vehicles arriving to help you rebuild after a disaster. Instead of sending the National Guard, they might be sending the National Guard along with their armies of recovery robots. Guys, like, it just gets crazier every day as these little puzzle pieces, and I start to remember like stories that we read not too long ago and go, whoa, look at this puzzle piece can go right in here. It just gets to me where I can't even believe that this is the future reality that we're going to leave for our children. I just can't. I mean, this isn't going to happen at a gradual pace. This is happening right now, all behind the covers. The stories are coming so fast that even I can't keep up with everything that's going on. I got stories lined up for 2-3 weeks before we can pop those puzzle pieces in. And if you aren't paying attention to this on a daily basis, this is all just going to slap you in the face like a big wet noodle at some point here in the not too distant future. Anyway, so whatever. Obama announces this whole thing. So here's this bill now that was announced, the Space Renaissance Bill. A breakthrough space technologies have improved the human condition and transformed nearly every aspect of our lives. And remember, this is this NASA DARPA yin and yang where a lot of this technology is coming out of. Way back when, we discovered a link between some of the suspended animation experiments that they had been doing and utilizing on a few key people in emergency room situations. And that was Gabby Giffords, where that was how they apparently, from her gunshot wound to the head, they were able to recover a lot of her mental faculties. Is that they put her into suspended animation. They've used it on football players now since then, where they drop them into a tub of ice water and lower their body temperature. So the brain requires less oxygen. And there have been stories before that about them experimenting with that in some of the deep, dark labs. But one of the things that are interesting is that Gabby Giffords' husband is an astronaut who has been on the space station. And he has direct connects to NASA and DARPA and some of their scientists. And maybe we will actually get there, because there have been a few things published on suspended animation and extended space travel here in the very recent past. So anyway, this space bill that has been, Space Renaissance Act that has been introduced, these benefits of space technologies to the human condition can be directly tied to the leadership of the United States of America in exploring and commercializing space. Unfortunately, continued socioeconomic growth from space technology maturation and increased space access is no longer assured. Space is becoming more congested. Like I said, we're all fighting to be a superpower. More congested, contested, and even competitive. So we must establish responsible governance that will prevent mishaps, misperceptions, and mistrust while assuring the use of space for all responsible parties. As a military pilot, and this is, I don't even know, does it say his name? Representative Jim Brindenstein, Oklahoma's 1st District, must be the guy who sponsored it. As a military pilot, I can attest that our national security and our very way of life require both military, ding, and commercial space capabilities. We're going to look at military next. Our space architectures must be resilient, and our national security terrestrial systems must be interoperable with both military and commercial space systems. So, guys, they're going to suck. More tech companies, more commercial enterprises into the military industrial complex. We found out a couple weeks back, DARPA had announced this new IUDX program, this experimental program to open up bidding outside of the federal contract program to commercial entities, anyone and everyone. If you got a product that might be able to help national security, wink, we're going to let you bid on it. You don't even have to be one of our approved vendors. We're going to let everyone and anyone offer us solutions to make us more competitive. But what this is actually doing is bringing in more brown shirts, guys. This is bringing in all of our previously independent, entrepreneurial, kind of Wild West type tech segment of our economy, and it is pulling them in to the federal framework. I mean, this is the place where jobs are. This is where the future really is moving forward with technology. There's no way we're going to be able to get around that, unfortunately. I really want to be a Luddite. But the future is moving toward connectivity, connecting everything to this Internet of Everything. We've talked a lot about that. And if you want to get a job in the future, if your children want to be employed in the future, it's going to have to be in one of these fields. And not only are all these corporations now being sucked into this military, industrial, federal surveillance connectivity complex, which includes precision medicine, mind you, our children and the programs that are being funded at the university level are also being sucked into the same complex. Well, now we're adding space to that. They're planning on getting off this rock. They've added some more components to where there'll be money to be made in the 21st century. And they are militarizing that as well. So he continues here. So this, our space architectures must be resilient in our national security terrestrial systems. It must be interoperable with both military and commercial space systems. We must be able to deter attacks, defend governments and commercial assets. Defending commercial assets, all in the name of national security, guys. And defend threats when necessary. And this really is like, what was that movie that took place with Schwarzenegger on Mars? Where they were mining. I mean, it's all, it's going to be a big, ugly commercial government entity that's going to be in charge here. As we work to ensure space security, commercial enterprise can continue to launch generational leaps in space technology, benefiting humanity and reducing government costs. Our regulatory framework must minimize burdens while maximizing certainty, and our civil and defense space enterprises must not compete with the private sector, but enable domestic commercial launch and space capabilities. So, in other words, we're all going to pat each other's butts and work together. Yay! When space exploration and development are in the national interest, but the risks are too high for commercial enterprises, then our civil agencies like NASA and NOAA, and yeah, we forget about NOAA. NOAA is the big seeing NASA eye in the sky. Must lead with a purpose to retire risks and commercialize programs. The purpose of this bill is to permanently secure the United States of America as the ding ding preeminent seafaring nation. So, didn't I tell you the new space race of the 60s has continued again, except we've been called now to the mat about whether or not we actually made it to the moon the first time, because now we are competing with lots of other nations and commercial entities. So if you can't win, you might as well join them. They want to suck these entities into the federal machine to be able to manipulate and control them as a part of the framework. So the mission of H.R. 4945, the American Space Renaissance Act, is to permanently secure the United States as the preeminent space-faring nation, i.e., the one who is in charge of space, the space superpower. This ASRA, or American Space Renaissance Act, has three key objectives. One, protect military strength, ding, and protect our space-based capabilities. Number two, provide certainty to encourage commercial space innovation. And number three, promote stability, accountability, and mission clarity at NASA. And it goes on and on. Actually, this might be a good kickoff point. So every component of modern warfare, air, land, and sea, requires space capabilities to deliver optimum effects. The enemies of the United States are developing, testing, and fielding capabilities to counter America's space advantage. And we also found that China and India have space programs. Besides Russia and the UK, which their lander is landing on Mars next week, and they were the other two signors on that space treaty in 1967 with us. And then we have all these commercial entities, of course, that NASA is going to partner with. And NASA being the yin of the yang of DARPA, which is the DOD. So we're all a big, cozy, happy family in space. But the enemies of the United States are developing, testing, and fielding capabilities to counter America's space advantage. We must build more resilient space and ground architectures. And this is where a lot of this pulse weaponry on satellites comes in, where we were talking about a few weeks back. We must build more resilient space and ground architectures, improve commonality and interoperability in space enterprises. And this is this whole merging of 5G and millimeter wave and pulse weapons. We also must operate a multi-domain, which is airspace and cyberspace. Don't forget about that. We're the Air Force holistically, as well as utilizing commercial enterprise to rapidly distribute architecture. You know, that's the one thing. So the Air Force is also the one that took control of that X-37B once the space shuttle program was shut down and then it was handed over to DARPA. They have been going on secret missions with that space plane, and we found out from Bruce Gagnon that X-37B might also be utilized for some sort of space commands as well as space-based weapons. Let's read about the United States Space Command here. The United States Space Command was a unified combatant command of the United States Department of Defense, created in 1985. And you know what? I don't know if you guys remember, but good old Star Wars. Star Wars was taking place where they were questioning whether or not we could even put it into space. There were protests against it. I think other countries were not too happy about our Star Wars program to be able to shoot nukes and weapons utilizing some sort of space laser weaponry. It was right around that very time. I was in college in those days, and they had Star Wars protests going on. So, yes, the United States Unified Combatant Command of the United States Department of Defense was created in 1985 to help institutionalize the use of outer space by the United States Armed Forces. The Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Space Command, which is headquartered at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, also functioned as the Commander-in-Chief of the binational U.S.-Canadian North American Aerospace Defense Command. So, did you know we are working with Canada on that as well? With a majority of the time spent during the U.S. Space Command's existence, also as the commander of the U.S. Air Force Major Command of the Air Force Space Command. Military space operations coordinated by U.S. Spacecom proved to be very valuable for the U.S.-led coalition in the 1991 Persian Gulf War. U.S. military relied on space communications, satellite communications, intelligence, navigation, missile warning, and weather systems. So that's where NOAA comes in the areas of conflict, since at least the early 1990s, including the Balkans, in Southwest Asia and in Afghanistan, and space systems have since then been considered as an indispensable provider of tactical information to U.S. forces. As an ongoing part of the initiative to transform the U.S. military on June 26, 2002. So not even a year after 9/11. Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, announced that U.S. Space Command would merge with U.S. STRATCOM. Oh. The Unified Command Plan directed that the Unified Combatant Commands, he capped at 10, with the formation of the new United States Northern Command. One would have to be deactivated in order to maintain that level, and thus the U.S. Space Command merged into an expanded U.S. STRATCOM, which would retain the U.S. Strategic Command name and would be headquartered at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. So now it's out of Nebraska. This merger aimed to improve combat effectiveness and speed up information collection and assessment needed for strategic decision making. Within STRATCOM, responsibilities for space were first held by the Joint Functional Component Command for Space and Global Strike until 2006, when the command was divided. And as of 2016, the Joint Functional Component Command for Space oversees all of U.S. military space operations. Now, if I'm not mistaken, too, somewhere in here, we were reading about the whole NSA and Cyber Command and all these other different facets of the NSA's Cyber Command. They were connected to the very highest level, including some of these joint upper level command components that answer directly to the President of the United States. And they announced that cyber warfare would be considered an act of war. So the Joint Functional Component Command for Space that is now in charge of 2016 is a component of the U.S. Strategic Command. Their mission is to ensure the freedom of action in space while preventing adversarial use of space against us. To do this, the component organizes planning, execution, force management, and it is directed by the U.S. STRATCOM. Guys, it's, you know, right now there is another world war going on, except it's not necessarily happening here on Earth. I think it is happening in space. Here's this newest story now, that X-37B that appeared again in the news. Weird that we talked about it, and then Bruce talked about it. I didn't even know he talked about it. I followed it, though, for a very long time. And now there's a brand new story, came out yesterday. A mystery space plane has been orbiting Earth for 500 days, and we still don't know why. What the Air Force isn't telling us. On May 20th, 2015, the U.S. military launched the robotic X-37B space plane into Earth's orbit to carry out its fourth top secret mission. Now, more than 500 days later, the solar-powered unmanned drone, and that's what I was postulating, was that this probably was a good experiment for UAVs utilizing some sort of lower Earth orbit that they haven't done en masse before, but they are building that whole new tracking system for drones. Remember, too, they are commercializing drones. The FAA is giving out licenses now as of a few months ago. We're going to have drone pizza delivery one day soon. Amazon drones, Walmart drones, you just wait and see. But they're trying to build an air traffic control system for all of this. NASA has been announced that they will be working with Verizon as well as 30 or more other commercial entities on building this communication infrastructure. And remember, again, we plugged in a lot of this 5G millimeter wave and tying into the cell networks as well as high frequency bandwidth for Wi-Fi at the gigahertz level and terahertz level. I think it was the new speed was 1 terabyte a second they were talking about. And, of course, this will enable us to get, like, real-time VR goggles beamed from the sky. But anyway, on May 20th, 2015, the U.S. military launched the robotic X-37B space plane, the baby space shuttle, into Earth's orbit to carry out its fourth top-secret mission. Now, more than 500 days later, this solar-powered unmanned drone is still up there, and with no word on how long it will remain in orbit or what it is actually doing up there, it is spurring the same kinds of conspiracy theories that followed it through its previous missions. Weird, man. Like, this just came out of the blue again. I haven't talked about the X-37 in a really long time. We just talked about it last week, and now there's a spacealert.com. Oh, yeah, there's conspiracy theories. You know, there is that tracker. I'll see if I can find out its newest, this 500-day mission number. It's OTV4, I see. I will plug that tracker that I have on my Earth Sky Tools where you can real-time track this, and maybe we can have some fun with it. So is it deploying spy satellites in the Earth's atmosphere? Is it interfering with signals of other satellites? Is it part of the Pentagon's research into drone-based weaponry? Ding. Or has it been keeping tabs on China's ill-fated space station this whole time? We talked about that yesterday as well. Pieces fall on the Earth over the next year. Your guess is as good as mine, but what we do know is that during its 500 days in orbit, it has been carrying several payloads, a few of which have been identified. It has ferried a couple of prototype electric propulsion devices from the Air Force and private aerospace and defense company Aerojet Rocketdyne. Plus, it also got collateral from NASA's Advanced Material Investigation. So I got to wonder what that is. Is that part of DARPA's Advanced Material Program, which aims to test how the space environment affects certain materials? It remains a very useful way to test things out, says Winston B. Beauchamp, Deputy Undersecretary of the Air Force for Space, during last month's American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics meeting in California. The Air Force's first such mission, oh, that was the first one, called the OTV-4, was launched in April 2010. Almost immediately, the public was suspicious. But it only got worse when several amateur observers reported that space planes flied over the same region of ground every 4 days. You know, we'll finish this story tomorrow because this is a good kickoff point. All right, guys, make sure you stick around. Kevin Blanchard live up next. Lots of great radio tonight. And I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody, take care.
My name is S.M. Gibson, and I am the host of